Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Welcome back to our podcast series, Mindfulness Where Dharma Meets Practice. This is the final talk in the series and concludes the topic, Living in the Midst. Recall that we are considering ways we can organize our lives to more fully embrace the Buddha's way. Simplicity. In a favorite story from the suttas, an older monk was often heard by the other monks to exclaim, "What bliss, what bliss!" Since he had, as a layman, been a king, they didn't assume that he was enjoying the delights of the renunciate life, but rather that he was reminiscing about his previous cushy life. Upon word of this, the Buddha summoned the monk and discovered that the monks were underestimating his level of attainment. This was his account. "Before, when I was a householder maintaining the bliss of kingship, I had guards posted within and without the royal apartments, within and without the city, within and without the countryside. But even though I was thus guarded, thus protected, I dwelt in fear, agitated, distrustful, and afraid. But now, on going alone to a forest, to the root of a tree, or to an empty dwelling, I dwell without fear, unagitated, confident, and unafraid, unconcerned, unruffled by my wants, satisfied with my mind like a wild deer. This is the meaning I have in mind when I repeatedly exclaim, 'What bliss, what bliss!'" What this simple monk had left behind is not so different from the lives many of us live, with an asset-laden personal footprint protected by high-tech security system and financial advisor. More to the point, reducing our personal footprint or that of our family is one way to reduce the desperation we may feel about livelihood as we thereby broaden our employment options. Part of what makes simplicity possible is also to be humble enough to let go of our ego involvement or identification with income or profession, as this venerable monk clearly had. Simplicity also means more time for practice or for other wholesome pursuits. More generally, simplicity benefits Buddhist practice, for it entails renouncing much of what, through our attachments, causes suffering. Nonetheless, at a given time, our attachments may not be negotiable. A group of rather lively laypeople once approached the Buddha to ask for spiritual guidance, but made clear that certain comforts and responsibilities were not up for discussion.
"We, Lord, are laymen who enjoy worldly pleasure. We lead a life encumbered by wife and children. We use sandalwood of kasi. We deck ourselves with garlands, perfume, and unguents. We use gold and silver. To those like us, O Lord, let the Exalted One preach the Dharma, teach those things that lead to weal and happiness in this life and to weal and happiness in future life."
Modern people's list of comforts might similarly include football, financial success, designer clothing and great hair, wild parties, fast women and fast cars, abundant thumbs up for our social media posts. Significantly, the Buddha does not dismiss the lively group as unworthy of his teaching, but respects that they have made certain choices about the shape of their lives, and so takes what they have said as parameters within which Buddhist lives can nonetheless take root. How we live our lives is our choice. In the future, we may make other choices. Certainly, family is a central point of attachment in most lives. As we survey our lives, many attachments will be relatively wholesome from a dharmic perspective, others quite unskillful and prone to harm and unhappiness. We should give special attention to letting go of the more unskillful. For instance, an amateur hunter might trade rifle for binoculars and instead take up bird watching. Moreover, contemplating our situation, we're likely to discover that many once seemingly pleasurable pursuits are the most painful and problematic in our lives, that popularity or endless partying or sexual intrigue does not bring anything like lasting happiness, quite the contrary. This investigation can and should go on for many years by being mindful of the Dharma even as we continue to step over its boundaries. Over time, our attachments may drop away like old toys from the newly adolescent. Buddhist wisdom reveals that there is little worth keeping. The burden, attachment, and enmeshment in samsaric existence they entail are just too dear a price to pay. It's mindfulness of such wisdom that brings our lives slowly into greater alignment with Buddhist principles. Simplicity is making our personal footprint the domain of our own affairs, what we choose to have a personal stake in, as small as we possibly can. Everything we've brought into our lives has come at a cost to our well-being. Like a well-run corporation, we tend to externalize costs in our own minds, seeing only the attractive side of things, even while we covertly bear the costs. Simplicity will nonetheless be a welcome relief as we let go of things like long commutes, debt, chauffeuring of adolescents, the constant ringing of the phone, bills, nagging neighbors, the threat of lawsuits, divorce, and keeping up with never-ending housework or with the Joneses. It will free up time and obligations in our lives and give us more freedom to shape our lives as we see fit. Being devoted. We can at least be devoted to what we fail to simplify out of our lives. We have seen the importance of devotion to the Triple Gem as the prime, wholesome, selfless motivator of Buddhist practice. Devotion is something we can similarly develop for many external pursuits in our lives: marriage, career, education, hobby, music, political activism. Devotion turns any such pursuit away from unskillful striving, instead directing us towards selflessness, mindfulness, proficiency, and satisfaction. Interestingly, what we call hobbies are almost always, but usually implicitly, topics of great devotion. Surfing, knitting, bird watching, football, collecting string, bowling, karate. It seems to me connoisseurs, epicures, and gastronomes are people who bring an element of devotion into what otherwise would be pure self-serving striving for sensual satisfaction, turning, for instance, the guzzler into the discriminating sipper of fine wines and the glutton into the gourmet. This may be how elites make life a little more bearable. The absence of practical purpose beyond the activity itself explains why other people may view our hobbies as pointless and connoisseurs as silly, but also why our hobbies provide quite palpable and welcome relief from the relentless drive for personal advantage with which we tend to be afflicted during most of the day. It's noteworthy that such secular areas of devotion are typically accompanied by a sometimes religious level of ritual. Consider, for instance, how much ritual is observed at a gourmet restaurant in simply opening a bottle of fine wine. We can never entirely eliminate striving towards goals from our lives. How would we become educated, build a career, or even become awakened? Luckily, we can often moderate our goal orientation mentally quite easily in favor of wholesome, selfless motivations without substantially changing the outer form of the pursuit, nor sacrificing the goal, but in a way that benefits our practice and well-being. Often this is simply a matter of how we frame our goal. For example, dieting. Most typically, one diets with the explicit goal of a sexier, slimmer, 20 pounds lighter me on the beach next summer. This goal is achieved by keeping eyes on the prize while undergoing starvation and exercise, a process that provides little satisfaction in itself. For as any dieter knows, there is a lot of emoting and suffering in the process, constantly weighing oneself, continually prodded by shame and longing for the end result. Moreover, when the goal is reached, satisfaction is short-lived, for now one must, by the same means, maintain one's sexier, slimmer, and healthier me for the following summer. Alternatively, one might instead frame the same pursuit in terms of a simple health standard to bear in mind, that of living an optimal lifestyle with daily nutritional intake and bodily activity optimized for one's body type. The standard never lies in the future but is achieved each day. In case of lapse, one acknowledges it and determines to do better the next day. There is mindfulness and effort involved, but no striving or emoting. In fact, as one inhabits this practice, one is very likely to become an expert on nutrition, on exercise, and on the other real needs of the human body to which one's attention is directed, in lieu of standing on the scale each day and emoting accordingly. One finds satisfaction in the process itself. One becomes devoted to this aspect of health and joyful. As an extra benefit, one attains with ease the goal one gave up in the first place. Devotion also applies to our larger pursuits in life as well, such as education, marriage, and child rearing, much as it does to Buddhist practice. Do we go to college to study what we can turn into a lucrative profession, like business management, medicine, law, or electrical engineering? Or do we go to college to study what we really love? Not that we can't love the foregoing, like medieval French poetry, theoretical linguistics, existentialist philosophy, or Buddhist studies. Pursuing the latter is likely to seem foolish to others, particularly to one's parents. But the deeper level of proficiency achieved in doing so might end up surprising everybody. Joseph Campbell is said to have written somewhere, "I say, follow your bliss and don't be afraid, and doors will open where you didn't know they were going to be. If you follow your bliss, doors will open for you that wouldn't have opened for anyone else." I can report that my life bears this out. My bliss in graduate school was theoretical linguistics, not because I was following Campbell's sage advice, but because I've always been foolhardy by nature. Sure enough, trained in a field where employment is the remotest possibility, doors did open up for me one by one that I never would have expected. Where they ended up leading me has come as a complete surprise, and I'm not aware that that particular series of doors has ever opened for anyone else. Similarly, marriage can be a means to an end or a meaningful end in itself. Does the marriage serve us, or do we serve the marriage? With insufficient devotion, it might be a means to sex, social prestige, housekeeping, childcare, and meal preparation, or to material comfort, security, and luxury. Seeking personal advantage in this way is always a source of suffering and a hindrance to spiritual development. And also the marriage is easily abandoned in favor of trading up to a more promising partner. With devotion, on the other hand, marriage is a refuge, likely pursued mindfully, with sensitivity and deeply as a source of personal satisfaction, intimacy, and meaning. We see that devotion to even extra Buddhist pursuits resonates well with the Buddhist path in that it leads to a pure mind and is not so different from the devotion we bring to Buddhist practice. On the other hand, striving for personal advantage can easily infect both secular and religious domains. Many of us, particularly in the beginning years of Buddhist practice, show great pride, compare ourselves to others, excel in debate, and boast great attainments in the higher meditations. When we apply the higher meditations to achieving mystical states, perhaps known only to ourselves, we are also striving, craving, and suffering, which are actually impediments to the calm and composed mind. When we meditate for its own sake, with no goal in mind, simply out of devotion, that is best. A famous Zen koan reads, "Jiaozhou asked Nanchuan, 'What is the way?' Nanchuan said, 'Ordinary mind is the way.' Jiaozhou asked, 'Then may I direct myself toward it or not?' Nanchuan said, 'To turn toward it is to turn away from it.'" Community involvement. We've seen in previous podcasts the weight the Buddha put on community involvement in Buddhism, and in particular the importance of having admirable friends. There are a number of options in Western lands for encountering like-minded people, all of which can be quite wonderful, but whose appropriateness at any time depends on our current level of practice or what level of practice we aspire to. In the USA, we find basically four kinds of community organizations. One, meditation groups generally focus on a single practice with limited resources for those who wish to be involved holistically. Two, Western temples generally appeal to European Americans, however, generally intent on achieving ethnic and racial diversity, identify with a particular Asian school of Buddhism, and are led by people with a degree of knowledge and experience. What is generally missing is a sangha. Three, Eastern temples generally serve a particular ethnic group of Asian origin. You might be surprised at how many of these there are in the most unexpected places in the USA. Eastern temples fall into two categories relevant to our purposes. A. Asian missionary temples seek to promote Buddhist practice and understanding to people outside of their core ethnic base. They are likely to have a bilingual sangha and offer some programs in English. And B, Asian neighborhood temples are generally founded by a local ethnic community and are surprised but happy when someone from outside the community shows up. I imagine Asian neighborhood temples represent the greatest preponderance of American Buddhism. It's surprising how many Westerners who will go on an expensive vacation to exotic lands will not venture into Eastern temples, where they are challenged by language, culture, peculiar devotional practice, and unfamiliar statuary for free. Bearing in mind that much of the religiosity is a later, albeit harmless, development, this is typically where we find Buddhist life in its most complete holistic form. In particular, this is where the Sangha is fundamental. The importance of the monastic institution to Buddhism is evident in the significance the Buddha attached to it, as he consistently referred to the entirety of his teachings as the doctrine and discipline, in reference to the monastic code laid down by the Buddha. Accordingly, Buddhist communities have faithfully and willingly upheld the Sangha throughout history in virtually every Buddhist land as a kind of social contract between monastic and lay. Remarkably, the Sangha is probably the most enduring institution on the planet, still following significantly the same discipline after 100 generations. The pure monastic Sangha functions as a kind of universal counterculture, standing against many of the mainstream currents found in whatever culture it is embedded, and for the quite radical ancient values and social norms espoused by the Buddha. It even distinguishes itself in coiffure and apparel, much like beatniks, hippies, punks, and goths. It provides a reality check for the mainstream culture to the notion that personal excess leads to happiness, with each monk or nun serving as a very visible walking science experiment, a test tube in which the ingredients of the highest standards of Buddhist life have been poured and then stirred with results open for all to inspect. The Sangha provides the laity with the world's cheapest clergy, a rich source of admirable friends, a fertile field for making merit, and an abiding influence on the general culture. The Sangha also offers a unique opportunity for the most devout and engaged Buddhists. Membership secures the optimal social conditions, material support, and insulation from the kinds of vulnerabilities encountered in the midst in order to progress on the path of awakening. There was a time for me when monastic practice would have been a wild flight of fantasy, but I discovered that it is quite doable even for a European American, and my practice and understanding have benefited enormously from this step. I would encourage readers not to dismiss monastic practice as a real option. A core function of the discipline is systematically to prohibit virtually every opportunity for seeking personal advantage, self-enhancement, or self-gratification. In this regard, it prohibits sexual relations and economic activity and tightly regulates ownership of property. It prohibits beautifying oneself or engaging in any normal livelihood or exchange. Monastics are not even allowed purposely to endear themselves to lay people with the aim of receiving better offerings of food and clothing. Since the monastic code allows one to do almost nothing for oneself, me has virtually no permitted function and easily loses its foothold, though it might continue for a time to haunt the mind. This kind of life would leave the monastic extremely vulnerable were it not for entrusting her needs to the benevolence of the laity. In return, monastics require little, and while helpless with regard to themselves, there are virtually no limits on what the monastic can do for others. For the Westerner, joining the Sangha generally entails living in Asia or affiliating oneself with an Eastern temple in the West that supports the Sangha in the traditional way, since so few Western temples succeed in supporting a Sangha. This has certainly been my path, having been welcome in Myanmar and in Burmese American temples, but able to serve both Western and Burmese communities. Last words. Mindfulness is not a state of mind. It is something we do. We recollect. And it is something that has an object. We are mindful of something. That something ranges without limit in Buddhism over the entirety of the Dharma, over the entirety of the discipline, and by analogy can be used to bring the extra Buddhist externals of our life more or less in accord with the example of the Dharma. This, along with the specialized training in becoming more mindful, makes mindfulness very powerful in our lives. Moreover, mindfulness in a range of applications is closely shadowed by mental composure, which is a state of mind, one that brings serenity and clarity and amplifies the power of mindfulness even further. It's important to bear in mind that Buddhism is eminently practical. Its natural roots are not in lofty philosophizing, but in real communities, in human interaction, in the practice of harmlessness, kindness, and generosity toward one another, and in engagement in everyday affairs. The Buddha's thinking emerged from the nuts and bolts of practice realities in life, and it is here where mindfulness practice finds its place. It's important as we enter into Buddhist practice, perhaps a little bit at a time, to keep this all-inclusive perspective in mind. The Buddha's message was quite radical and continues to be radical when properly understood, both personally and socially. His message does not begin with transcending the human condition. It only ends there.
Further resources related to this course, Mindfulness, Where Dharma Meets Practice, are available at Sitagu, that is Sitagu, sitagu.org/shortlinks/mindful.